Hello again, everybody. Welcome. This is Julie Knudsen with podcast number 81 on Turning the Pointing Labrador. And I am back all in one piece from my big race in Hawaii. Let me just say, I've never been to Hawaii before. And wow, is that ever gorgeous. That is really nice. Fantastic weather, but just a beautiful place. So everybody that gets to vacation and or live or spend a lot of time there, lucky folks. What a gorgeous place. Wonderful time. I lived through it. It was kind of tough, but now we're back and we can just dog it straight through. And I'm going to trying to get several things done on this podcast because, again, it's been a week or two since the last one. I want to finish up on some puppy things. And then I want to address some listener questions because I've gotten quite a few of those. And some of them are fairly in-depth, so I'm going to try and address that, kind of get everything wrapped up here. Hunting season is definitely on us now, and people are all real serious about stuff. And some of the questions I have are kind of related to that. But before that, I want to finish off some puppy things. And this is going to be more puppy things related to the hunting dogs. And particularly dogs that are also going to be upland hunters. Whether they point or don't point really isn't the key thing. It's just about the bird exposure and young puppy stuff. What I hear very frequently, people buy an upland dog or a dog that they're going to, amongst other things, use for upland hunting, pheasant or grouse or quail or, you know, whatever bird you have. Or they just like upland hunting a lot, which I prefer because you get to move versus sit unless you're jump shooting ducks. You know, a lot of times you're just sitting. So upland hunting is a lot of fun because you get to, you know, you're out there with your dog and you guys are moving through the field. But if you're getting a dog and that's part of it, one of the things that you always hear from everybody, you heard it from the bird dog guys and you hear it from the retriever people, is that, you know, young dogs need exposure to birds. And boy, when people undertake that, they run a gamut of what they think it is that exposing your dogs to birds are. They're shooting over them, and they've got pheasant, and they got this, you know, all kinds of interesting things. Now, there's not one way to do this right. And it's not like, okay, I'm going to tell you how to do this. And don't listen to anybody else, because that's not how this works. But like with everything else, you need to really understand where the dog's coming from and how they think, and then do your best to make that work for what your desired outcome is. That's very, very important. The other thing that I would strongly encourage people to do, when you got a little puppy and you want it to eventually be a really good upland and, you know, waterfowl dog, whatever it is you've got planned, I ask people to detach from the outcome. When the goal is what you're emphasizing and working on a daily basis, that usually is very counterproductive. And what I mean by that is, you know, I've had seen so many people, they have a little dog, and let's just talk about pointing retrievers, because that's kind of what this podcast emphasizes a lot. You know, they get a little dog out there and it points and they're out there, they got cords and they're stopping it and they're using whoa commands and they're trying to make it be like they want it to be when it's 2 or 3 years old. And so we just start right now. That does not work, rarely. I'm sure somebody did it and they got a great dog, like always. Everything I say, there's a zillion exceptions to. But when you are result-oriented versus process-oriented, a lot of times you create a lot of problems. So to get from a little puppy to your superstar upland dog, to do that, what you want to do is take the path that is the easiest, the most natural, and the one that gets you where you want to get, without fuss, without problems, without corrections, without a lot of difficulty. So to do that, let's take a little puppy brain. A little puppy brain is not really good at interpreting, at processing, at cause and effect. You know, they don't know anything but just basically these autonomic responses that they have. And some of them have them early, and some of them don't have them early, and everything in between. So as I said before, find out from your little dog. Let him tell you, you know, boy, this is an advanced guy. He's already, you know, way ahead of where I would expect an 8 or 10 or 12-week-old puppy to be. Or just kind of a little lumpy one. You just can't remember where the door is. None of those necessarily reflect on what the eventual outcome is going to be. It's just what you have. So take that little brain that is just a puppy brain and is just figuring out what this life thing means and understand that's what you've got. So when you have a little baby, and I'll tell you what I like to do, and so you can find a variation of this, but when I have a dog that I want to be a really great upland dog, particularly if the pointing is important, if you never get them on birds until they've done a ton of retrieving and a ton of aggressive retriever work, and they've grown up and they have a lot of, you know, developed thoughts, and then all of a sudden we're going to start this, you are disadvantaged compared to if you start from the beginning with these little guys and let them begin to conceive of this live bird idea. If that makes sense, I hope it does. Because if you think about it, and I've said this before in these things, the aggressive go-get-it, you know, force-fetch retriever work is you go find that bird, and wounded, you know, still alive or whatever, you go get it and you bring that back. And you practice a lot of that, then you develop that kind of thinking. What you want on a good pointing dog is a dog that locates a convincing presence of a live bird, and they stop. And they point this location out to you, preferably quite a bit far away from it. And training can affect that very strongly. But that's not an aggressive behavior. That's the opposite of aggressive. That's a very, very, that's a non-behavior. That's a completely passive thing. And if you only develop one of those and not the other one when they're little, then you've got a lopsided situation here. So we have retrievers because we like retrieving. And when we have one that also points, then we really like that, and we also have the retrieving. So it is generally a better thing to develop those two things side by side as the puppy grows up without one dominating over the other one. So on your little 8, 10, 12-week-old dogs, exposure to live birds can be extremely useful. And I do it on any of the little guys that I have, or my clients when they get a little puppy. You know, we start right off. So there's a lot of ways to do this. And, you know, the bird dog guys are very good at this. No great big birds. No bird that's going to scare them to death. You know, quail are really nice. It's really hard to house quail. They were my favorite. I had Johnny houses. Just fantastic way to introduce dogs to live birds. I haven't been able to do that because they just don't stay alive unless they're kept up off the ground, and our pens are on the ground. So I love quail. So right now what I have are chukar. I don't use pheasants ever for obvious reasons for puppies. Man, those guys they're scary. They hurt people. You know, I don't want to see what they could do to a little dog that scared them. But I'll take, when I have a pen full of chukar, and I have one that's kind of maybe the low chukar on the totem pole, so they're kind of beating up on him, or one that's just, I don't know, old or just not as robust as the others. I'll go get that bird with my gloved hands, clean gloved hands, and I'll go take the bird that's probably not just going to pop out of there the minute it senses the presence of a dog, any pressure from a dog. And I will put it somewhere where it's kind of just nestled down and comfortable. I don't dizzy it. I don't render it where it can't get away if it needs to. But it's just kind of happy. I'll just sit over here and put it in a nice spot where scent can build up. So there's a lot of thinking. Where can I put this? You know, what's the wind direction? Is it going to be easily? Don't put it 6 feet into heavy cover, because no 8-week-old puppy is ever going to have a clue that there's a bird there. So you put it somewhere. You know, I like to use our sparser, not the heavy grass stuff, but the sparser stuff where we have sagebrush. And, you know, that imparts a lot of smell to it, but it, you can carry smell pretty well. So more of a prairie grass kind of place. Stick it down somewhere in between a couple things, and let's let it sit there. And you got to let the scent build up a little bit. You can't just go 30 seconds later and put the dog on it, because that, as that bird sits there, if the wind's not real high, right, the scent can begin to build up a little bit. And you have to place it somewhere so when the dog, little puppy, goes by, it has a good chance. There's an obvious place to go by. You know, it doesn't have to be jumping through heavy stuff because it doesn't know to do any of that. So if you guys were just walking by on the path, and it would be able to get a good scent of this bird that wasn't very far away, so that you could make sure you gave it every chance to have a good contact. That doesn't mean it will. You know, half the time those little suckers will walk right by, and everybody's just, oh, crestfallen. Oh, no, he's no good. Look at that. But that's because, it's not because they don't have a nose. It's because there's no connection between the nose and the thinker. And so it doesn't know what to think. The scent goes in the nose, and it just sort of ends there in the olfactory nerves, because there's nothing to be processed. There's no context for this. So a lot of times if they don't recognize it, then they don't recognize it. But if they do, okay, now they can smell this bird. It's not going to pop out of there right away. This is a little puppy now. And sometimes it can even get close. It could get real close. I've seen the best points right there. When they get a really convincing scent of this bird, and the bird hasn't moved yet, and they can't see it, but it's right there, you get these awesome little A-week old puppy points. Oh, it's just thrilling. And then generally what happens is they catch themselves. Sometimes they stay there a long time and don't do anything. Just stay out of it. This is a dog and a bird getting their thing going. If you sit there for 2 minutes, so be it. But eventually either they'll just lose interest and they'll turn away, you know, or they'll walk forward. And if the bird's still sitting there, they might, you know, put a foot on it. They might, you want the bird good enough that if the dog comes right up to it, it can at least, you know, run away or fly away, and that's fine. Sometimes if they grab onto it, they do, but, you know, that's not that. Just take it out of its mouth and make it where they can't chase it around too much. When you can give encounters like that where there's no pressure. Now, I just told a little simple story that had 15 zillion things going on, because I made sure the bird was encounterable. I made sure that they could smell it without seeing it. But if it wasn't very far away, that they could encounter the bird, that the bird could escape when it came time, and that I stayed out of it entirely. I didn't require the dog to be an avid hunter, to have to go through a bunch of stuff to get it. I just made everything available, and I'll just walk the dog by. Now, if the dog doesn't catch it, doesn't detect the scent, you don't stand there and you don't put pressure on the little animal and on the bird. You do not put pressure. Look, it's right here. Take him by again. Here, set him over here. All of that is pressure. You're paid a lot of money for the puppy, right? And you had to buy these birds now. And so we have some expectation. And so you're trying to take this rare opportunity that you have to make something happen. You can't, that doesn't work. I'm just going to say, don't do it. So if the dog never detects the bird, then go ahead and pick the bird up and hold it and let the dog come over and smell it and say, go, holy cow, what is that? Let them, you know, and maybe if they show interest, yay. And if they don't, it's too early. So beginning with things like that, we're not shooting anything. We're not steady. We're just letting the dog begin to understand that this exists in this world. And it's something that they are going to be learning about. And it may take 2 or 3 encounters like that, or it may take 20. You just don't know. And whatever you get is what you get. And you can't make it be better, and you can't make it be anything but what it is. And this develops at the range that the rate it develops. That's all there is to it. And if you stay out of it and let the dog just engage with the bird on its own and do whatever kind of thinking and understanding that they need to do until they begin to get the game. And as soon as they begin to understand this, then you can see it. And you might have a 12-week-old dog or a little older or a little younger. When you go out to this place where, oh, they're already looking right now. They're already thinking that this is out there. That's great progress. And so when they do begin to engage with these birds, now instead of just putting it somewhere easy to smell and easy to find, right? But now you might have to get a bird that's a little flightier that can get away. And you might want to tuck it down somewhere where it's going to have to work to get out of there. You don't want them catching them. If they do, certainly not the end of the world. You just don't want to make a habit of that. But they do have to be there enough that they can kind of, little, this is little guys now, where you know that they can kind of find it. And you don't want it to smell like your diesel-covered gloves. Or, you know, you want it to be as just bird-smelling as possible. And I've talked about that on the bird planting stuff. But when you do that with these little guys, ideally, I've always said once a week, I know how difficult that is. But if you want to train these guys and get the end result the best way possible, that's what it takes. Whether you have to drive a couple hours to a hunt club or pay somebody to, you know, house your quail or your chucker for you, it's worth it because it's a very, very narrow window. But when you do the early bird work on a good dog, the dividends are huge. So by the time that dog is a year old, now we're going to start steadying, now we're going to start wool breaking, now we're going to be able to draw down the control without losing the confidence in looking for birds. And the point, the real point, if it's there. So when people start going for the end result in the beginning, that is seeing these little dogs pointing, starting to steady them up, starting to do all kinds of advanced things that they are not ready for, you wind up killing the confidence and the beauty of what they're doing and turn them a little bit more into robots. And a lot of times they'll blink birds because birds, that means they're going on a bird and then go, uh-oh, every time I find a bird, I start getting in trouble. So they turn away or they go up and they dutifully stand or their heart is not in this. And that's because, one, they don't know what they're doing, or two, you know, somebody was trying to get the end result going and not go through the process to let this little dog learn how to do this really well. So once a week, and then as the dog gets better and more skilled, you've got to have birds that can, boy, are just going to get out of there if the dog gets too close. Because when you do what a lot of people do, you know, they have, okay, I have six birds, has to land all month, or last all month. And so they dizzy them, and they stick them down there, and they tuck them in there, and those dogs can get right on top of them. You know, then you're teaching dogs, hey, they never move. You can get right on, you can look them eye to eye if you want. And so, you know, that's almost always a top behavior when you see pointing retrievers do that. It's because people have been planting birds, and so the dog learns, shoot, I can get anywhere I want to, versus if I get, you know, if you're hunting real birds, the dog cannot look them eye to eye unless they're stuck in a snow thing and under when there's been snowfall. So they need to learn how to be wary and to not let birds just get away. And then, of course, fairly soon, not as puppies, later on you teach them they can't chase them all over the place. But that puppy part is important. And if you're going to get a pointing retriever, before you get the dog, find a way to be able to have some bird exposure. It may take a lot of work. It may take help from other people. You know, use your breeder if you're around them, if they can help you. But that's a really, you want to get the end result. That's the fastest way there, to do that without a bunch of intervention, without a bunch of correction, without a bunch of control, but to let that puppy and bird thing develop on its own. You know, I've just seen it so many times. And, you know, people, well, are they well broken? Have you done this or that? Nope, not at all. You know, and I get the look. They're looking at me like, what are you doing? You're a trainer. You know, it's like, I'm going to have this dog be fantastic when they're a little bit older. But right now, we're letting this whole process and let this dog get a lot of confidence. I didn't say wild and crazy chasing, but that I don't intervene with them and the bird. And, you know, I found it to work real well. So that's my little 20-minute puppy bird thing. It's real important. And at the same time, do your retrieves. You don't have to use birds on retrieves. You can if it doesn't mess stuff up. But the retrieving is also very important. And there we have manners, right? You watch, you see it go down, you go get it, and you bring it back, even as a little guy. And if they stop liking to do that, find out what you've done to make them. Maybe too many rules. Maybe not enough rules, and they're just having too much fun and don't care. So keep that balance going on these puppies, and your result will come because you went through the process step by step very methodically. And paying attention to what kind of puppy you've got and what they respond to. Okay, that would be that. Now, so speaking of that, now I'm going to go to one of my questions. And it's a little bit lengthy. I'm going to read it to you because I'm not exactly sure what maybe some people, this will help people or not. But it's like, hi, Julie, I found your book when I got my pup a couple years ago. Love listening to your podcast. Appreciate the no-nonsense approach you have while being fair to the dog. Yeah? Good. I like no-nonsense. Okay, that being said, I've run into a challenge I'm not quite sure how to handle, and hoping you might be willing to share your insight. My dog is a little over 2.5 years old. Okay, so that's a fairly mature dog. And while we haven't been on birds near as much as you recommend, he's seen a number of pheasants over the past 2 seasons and always did extremely well. Okay, not sure what extremely well means, but we'll go with that. We've been in a weekly hunt training class, and he's been good with birds there also. I'm going to assume that's running marks, where they go and somebody shoots and throws a dead bird and he goes and brings it back. Those, I guess, for the most part are dead birds. I don't know if you guys are shooting flyers. However, this past weekend we had a lot of bird exposure. Okay, there's probably a little insight right there. So you haven't had a lot of birds over the last 2.5 years, a little bit of hunting, and now we had a whole bunch in one weekend. Pheasant hunt on Saturday, duck hunting for the first time on Sunday. Okay, that's a big deal if you've never duck hunted before and you're shooting ducks in the water. That's kind of a big change. And I got some chucker for steadiness training on Monday. Okay, I don't know what you mean by steadiness. Were these live birds you were going to shoot and make the dog sit still? I'm not sure on that. I wasn't familiar with chucker. They were just the bird I could get my hands on. And they all held extremely tight, so my dog grabbed each of them instead of flushing. So the dog didn't do anything wrong there. Obviously, this is a flushing dog that you have. And if the bird's just going to sit there, they're going to get it. That's what retrievers are supposed to do. I noticed he was extremely mouthy in bringing them back, and on one, didn't bring it back, but instead tried to run off with it. Okay, so I'm assuming these are live birds now. So these are live birds that you planted. I'm not sure, I guess, what steadiness you were working on. And so he reached in and grabbed them. They're alive. I doubt this dog has carried around a lot of live birds. I'm guessing. I don't know. I could be wrong. So when they've never had a warm little live bird in their mouth, it's a pretty exciting thing. It's a little bit like the teenage boys looking into the girl's shower room through a little hole in the wall. That's kind of what it's like. He did bring it back, but he's literally never done that before, not even as a puppy, probably because it was a live bird. Always team driven. I'll throw it, provide the fun. I'm sure I'm doing something to contribute this. My initial thought is that with all the bird exposure he's had recently and requiring more steadiness, maybe I'm putting too much pressure on him. No, I doubt that. My gut says to stay off birds for a while to make the process important again. But with pheasant season starting here, I'd rather not avoid it if it's not a solution. Okay, I would love to give you an answer to this, but I don't understand what, when you're talking about steadiness. You know, steadiness in duck hunting meant sit there till I send you for the duck. And steadiness in the upland field means when the bird flies and the shot goes off, you have to sit still. So those are the only kind of, I assume we're not talking pointing here because your dog is a flushing dog. So it sounds to me like, I'm guessing, that live bird, which is not like a dead bird or a frozen bird, or, I mean, that is a pretty exciting thing. And always when dogs first get those things, you know, when you're out doing upland work and my pointing guys grab a live bird, oh, I'll tell you, all bets are off. They might go, they go the other direction too, because these are predators, you know, and so all of a sudden they got live prey in their mouth. Whoa, that's pretty exciting. So based on what I can get out of this question, I'm going to say that that was just a live bird thing. Because when you go hunting, presumably your birds are at least wounded, if not dead, not just completely alive and fine. And your hunt training, I'm sure, you're either using dead birds, or if you guys are shooting birds, they're probably dropped. Otherwise, they'd fly away. So you might just have the live bird thing, and that's pretty exciting. So your dog has to have, you don't go out and teach live bird stuff, but usually if the dog is force-fetched at 2.5, I suspect you are, force-fetched and collar conditions, so they know they have to bring stuff back. Usually it's disobedience when they don't come when you call them. So even with a prize of a live bird and you call them, they should come to you. Mouthing it is not unexpected with that. So you're probably, your basic obedience needs to be a little bit better. So whether it's dead, half alive, or fully alive, and you call them, that he needs to come. I would work more on that than I would any of the other stuff. And if he's not force-fetched, that would be real helpful in how they handle things in their mouth. So I hope that answers it. I'm a little confused by some of what you said, but I hope maybe I gave you a little bit of an idea. All right, another question. And let's see. Okay, this is a, I got to find this here. I got a couple of them. There we go. Okay, this is kind of a big one. And I think a number of people might be interested in this. So bear with me. I'm going to read this one also. I was wondering if you would do a short session on canine transportation. Been a lot of coverage on training, nutrition, exercise, but no one's explained the details of transportation. I know it's completely normal and accepted practice in the professional world to have dogs in boxes, trailers, crates, etc. But in our anthropomorphic society, most people view these transportation items as negatives. That's unfortunate. With almost how could you put your dog in their attitude? My favorite, for example, is I love my dog, so he rides in the front seat with me. Yeah, it's probably overweight, too. All right, I try to make the assimilation of putting a child in a car seat, and I get confronted by someone when they see my dogs in a box in the back of the truck. But there is more to it than just prevention of accidents. That's true. All right, safety aspects aside, how can we know for certain that the dog's needs are met going down the highway in the back of a truck? I personally have an insulated box in my truck and good roto-molded crates inside my wife's van. So dogs traveling in confinement is great, especially when you have little kids. True. Not having the dogs bust out of the vehicle before you can get everything ready is amazing. That is also true. My main concern is appropriately meeting the dog's needs. Bless ya. My hunting dog is in the house full-time, and by keeping him in the house, he has not had the gradual exposure to climate change like an outdoor kennel dog would have had, thus not being acclimated to the colder temperatures. Is it reasonable for me to have him come from an environment that's about 70 degrees all the time, put him in a 30-degree box, travel down the highway for 2 hours, go hunting, get wet, ride back another 2 hours inside the 30-degree box, even if the box has bedding such as straw or shavings? Another scenario is I take this house dog all the way from Michigan to South Dakota in a box in the back of a truck, or should he be in a crate inside the cab? Will it help to acclimate him to the cold weather if he travels 14 hours without heat? I guess my question is, what are some transportation guidelines we could use? Great question. Great, great question. I guess really, what are some transportation guidelines we could use to ensure animals' needs are met and we are making appropriate decisions for the animal and not applying human characteristics to it, especially since I would not be able to hear any noises or distress from dogs in the back of the truck while traveling. Okay, good question. Good question. So there's a lot right there. Now, if you just have a kenneler kind of a crate, you know, there's just plastic with some wire, anything like that would need to be inside of a vehicle in the winter, no matter what, because there's no insulation and there's no way to hold in heat. Depending on what kind of dog boxes you have, Because, you know, I can take dogs. I have a trailer right now, and it's insulated and, you know, has all the stuff in it. And I could take them just about anywhere in anything, because the insulation that's in there, if you have just the right enough ventilation so that you don't have condensation, so that there's airflow, but that the heat that's generated by the dog within the box, particularly with the right kind of bedding, and you didn't mention the kind of bedding that I would use if I had that, but the insulation keeps that from being a 30 degrees going down the road. Now, if you have if the back of your truck is open, it's not a shell or something else, right, and you're going 75 miles an hour, okay, you got a wind chill out there, let's say it's 20 degrees and you're driving to South Dakota and you're going 75 miles an hour. All right, the wind chill there is extreme. However, that wind chill is not inside of a well-insulated dog box, so it's not really 30 degrees inside that dog box. And, you know, you can put actually a little temperature thing in there and see. So depending on the nature of the box, if you have one that's made for that kind of stuff, even your house dog is not going to be subject, you know, to 10 below zero. They just aren't going to. So, but if you just have a box with some bedding in it, all right, then all the heat that dog generates is going to go right through the metal, and then right, and that wind chill is just going to suck that heat off of there. So it depends. So even a dog that is generally acclimated to the house. Now, I hope you train a little bit and the dog gets out as the season is changing so that they do learn to be out there a half hour, hour outside doing stuff with you. Well, I mean, you know, that's just healthy. That they be out there that way, so that being, you know, their feet can be on the snow or on the cold stuff. That's, you have to literally physically condition them to be able to go hunt in colder weather for you. And in doing that, the dog becomes somewhat acclimated to that stuff. And then when you have the right kind of box for these dogs, you know, I don't care what people, I have people on my own trailer. They go, oh, it's so hot. It'll be sitting somewhere in the summertime. And I really open that door and stick your head in there. Because the way the good trailers are designed now, heat comes up, goes out, you know, there's fans, and it's never, if it's 100 degrees outside, it is not, you know, I don't know, probably 80, 75 degrees with air movement, which of course is the key. So the way things are built now, people are just wrong. So tell them to stick their head in a box if they're going to go challenge you, if you have a good one. If you don't, then inside the back seat in a crate is great. Dogs should be in crates because I have seen a dog fly out of a vehicle and break its neck. Very pleasant sight. If people could see that, they probably would not have their dog, you know, riding in the front seat with them. Certainly, they should at least be behind, but then they can take you out as they're going through the windshield. So, yeah, dogs should be confined if safety is the most important thing. But on the temperature deal, if you have the right box and you don't, you know, you make sure that they have water and you just double-check things, you can have a temperature sensor in there. You know, you can buy that stuff real easy. You can always know what it is, but it is a matter of the insulation and the right kind of ventilation, so there is no condensation of moisture and enough airflow. Straw is a terrible bedding, and shavings are not a very good bedding. If you want a really good bedding, use the bedding that these dogs would use in the wild, and that is grass hay, not alfalfa. That's really prickly. But you can fill a... You know, that's what people with outside doghouses use. You know, you fill that with grass hay. That way, if they chew on it, it's fine. It's like they're eating grass. And they nestle down into it, and it can puff up around them. And that's a really, you know, a really good thing. And it comes up around them, so they really can nestle into that. But the most important thing on that is the nature of the insulation and that wind chill when you're going down the highway. So, you know, obviously the box needs to be right up next to the cab. And if you had something over it, a shell or something, then you're dropping the effects of wind chill significantly. Because that's probably one of the most difficult things if you think about it. 75, it's like a 75 mile an hour wind when it's 20 degrees. That's going to be well below zero. But a dog generates a lot of body heat, and if that body heat is held within that box, even a house dog, they can be okay, depending on, you know, how good you have that, how well that box is insulated and meant for that kind of stuff. A lot of the regular boxes that you transport your dogs around in the summer will not, no, that is not okay. And so put that inside the back of your truck and you'll be fine. And anybody that thinks a dog in a crate is cruel is extraordinarily naive. The most valuable animals in the world that do life-saving services and stuff like that are confined. Right? They are confined. They are not allowed free rein all over the place just for their safety and their well-being. And also, particularly a working dog, particularly the kind that we have, you know, where they go and they're working for hours and hours, and then they really need to just rest. And, you know, when there's a lot of people and other dogs around, there's not a lot of good rest. And they go back into their cave, their little box. And animals love that. And we all who do it know they love that. They get a real good rest there. So, I hope that answers that question on that one. That's a very important topic. And again, you see stuff now, the trailers and things they have, dogs are in those things and they are just fine. And they're going 75 miles an hour in a 20 degree temperature, but because of the insulation and the nature of the airflow, they can be just fine. One last question, and then this is kind of going on and on. One last question. I had another question about conditioning dogs on this subject for hunting, particularly as the seasons are changing. And there's a number of things on the conditioning that is important. Just like I mentioned there, before you go hunting with your dog that lives in the house, and that's fine that they're living in the house, but before you do that, one of the most important things is feet. To the best of your ability, it would be very, very good to have dogs' feet hardened a little bit, abrasion resistant. And so, you know, the dogs that we train, we have tough ground. It's sand and gravel and cactus, and it's, you know, real rough. And so their feet get very, very abrasion resistant. They get very hard, and so they learn, their feet are tough, so if they're on something that's yucky, not sandburrs. Sandburrs are just a nightmare for anybody. But they can go on cold ground and rough ground and go longer than a dog that has, you know, the city park kind of feet. That's real important. And, you know, that should be year-round. But certainly before you go up where there could be ice and snow, which can be extremely abrasive, and just rip those feet up. You know, and if you're going somewhere like where there are sandburrs and you do need to use booties or something, you might want to do some practicing. You know, start with just a couple minutes and just get the dog accustomed if they have to wear footy. You know, they don't like that. The other thing you want to get them accustomed to before you go hunting in some of those places where they're going to get all shredded up are the vests and protective gear that, you know, there's a lot of protective gear. There's the foot stuff, which normally they hate. Certainly those vests. And that doesn't keep their faces from tearing all up, but it does keep their shoulders and their chest and a little bit of the underbelly sometimes from just getting shredded, because when they get serious about cutting through those cattails and some of that tough, tough vegetation that's there. But you need to get your dog adapted to moving and doing, you know, go throw some marks or whatever, take a walk with that stuff on until they begin to associate that with good things that are going to happen. So you don't dig them out and strap this stuff on and they're going, "What on earth have you done to me?" It's good if you could do that a little bit ahead of time. Toughen their feet up, you know, take them for a walk on the concrete. You know, I don't like that. That's not good for bones and stuff, but it's good for toe pads. Take them places, you know, as often as you can to harden those feet up, because hardened feet are very useful to a dog that's going to be hunting. And, you know, they're going to mindlessly be doing that. And they aren't going to even know they're tearing stuff all up till you get back at the end of the day and go, "What's the blood from?" You know, because the foot's open or the pad's torn or, you know, right across their shoulders, they just sliced a big bunch of stuff. Real important to do that. The temperature is somewhat, I mean, yes, it would be very good if you're going to be hunting in cold things, if your dog, you know, was somewhat acclimated to being somewhere other than inside the house. you need to go do a little bit of training, do a little, you got to get them fit, you know, so they can go hunt for half hour, hour at a time. So do that, in, if you can, where they can adapt, you know, early in the morning or when it's unpleasant, so that they get a little bit used to that. Also, for you guys, like my previous question, that are traveling, get them used to being in the box. Get them used to that. There's nothing wrong with spending a lot of time in there. When they're working, that box is a nice place to rest, rehydrate, you know, let the other dogs take a shot at it and really get some rest. So being used to getting back in your dog box is highly useful. And if you don't have one, you should get one. It is just the best thing for working dogs in a working environment. Really, really important. You need to have them if you're going to be hunting, depending on where you go and what you do, and they're going to be out there. Some of them might be out there for 20 minutes at a time. Some of them might be out there for an hour or two at a time. Okay, just like you, if you've been sitting on the couch watching NFL all this fall, and suddenly we're going to have you go run a half marathon, odds are it's going to be really unpleasant for you, maybe even harmful. And so you're asking these guys, you know how far these dogs run in half an hour? A lot more than half a marathon. They run a long distance while you're walking through these fields. And so just like you, before you did something like that, would have to do some preparation. And don't drop your dog out the back of the truck and have him follow after you. Because, oh golly, that's just, man. Like, then your dog's in better shape than you are. You too go out there and get used to doing some of this. Fitness is super important. Super important. And that way you're not going to damage yourself, and you aren't going to damage that dog and have them get exhausted and not see the barbed wire fence or not see the ravine that they're going to fall off of, or when they get tired. That's when a lot of bad stuff happens. So if you can, I should have been doing it already. If you want that dog out there running for an hour, he needs to be out there running for periods of time ahead of that. Because they don't tell you when they're hurt, and they don't tell you when they're dehydrated. And if you can't see them, they can't tell you they're overheated if it's hot while you're hunting. So you have to have them conditioned to this stuff, which means you have to do some work yourself. That's the only fair thing. So the cardiovascular, super important. The feet, the musculature, the strength, super important. Teach these dogs, it's another deal, teach these dogs to water. I don't know how many times I've heard, yeah, my dog will not drink water while he's hunting. Well, that's like you running your half marathon and never having a drink of water. Not good. Seriously not good. So teach your dog now, before you go hunting, and preferably before this podcast, take a squirt bottle, you know, like a bike bottle or something. Take a squirt bottle and squirt it down their throat. You need to teach them. You have to water. You have to water. You have to water. That's all I'm going to say. So if they don't like to water and they don't willingly drink out of your little fancy carry bowl, then pour it down their throat. Squirt it down their throat. Make sure that they get water. And if they're going to hunt for a lot, make sure that you have some reasonable, you know, Purina used to make power bars, which was such a great thing to have. And I don't know if anybody's got what they have on the market now, but you've got to, if they're going to be out there for the morning or whatever, you need to give them a little bit of fairly easily convertible energy, so that, not a bunch, but just a little bit, so they can keep going and water, just like an athlete. You know, we just think of them as dogs. We don't think of them as athletes. In the races I've been running, if I didn't hydrate and eat frequently, I would fall over dead. And it's just very important for these animals too, because they show a lot of enthusiasm does not mean they don't need that stuff. Particularly guys, with these guys that are getting 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, when they're really good at what they do, you know, make sure you take good care of them, because they need the hydration and the food every bit as much as those young guys, maybe even a little bit more. So that's the kind of conditioning stuff to do ahead of time. And also make sure that you talk to your vet or someone very knowledgeable about having the right first aid kit, which should include, and I'm not an expert on this, I'm not a vet, but you should have all kind of first aid stuff for big cuts, the antiviral, antibacterial, betadine kind of stuff for wounds, super glue for closing certain things. You know, we carry staples in case somebody runs through and just slices the top of their head, the skin on the top of their head open sometimes. Again, go with what your vet says, but ways to close things up. Because if they tear something wide open and you don't get to the vet for an hour, that's probably not going to close up again. The skin dries up and stuff. So the more you can do, you know, for a serious injury to help things before you get to the vet, that would be good. But those things are just, man, they're really important. Take a lot of water. Take the first aid stuff. Have that with you. Carry that dog water bottle with you and your own if you're going to be out there a lot for the whole time. And if you're ready for bad stuff, it generally a lot of times doesn't happen. Usually the bad stuff happens when you're, oh, golly. And in light of some of the things that have happened in the recent past to some very dear friends of mine, safety is more important than anything else. Don't hunt with somebody where the gun barrel's flying around. Don't hunt with somebody that shoots over your dog. Just, you know, if somebody's unsafe or something, leave. Because it's not worth what can happen. And some very bad things have happened. Because people are being good and trusting somebody, or just don't do it. You know, your dog and safety, and your safety is real important. So always make sure that everybody acts like your dog is the King of Sheba and nothing bad can ever happen to them. So that'll be the end of this one. I'll get on to some more stuff on the next one. I hope I got some of the big questions answered. And I wish everybody a safe and a really enjoyable hunting season. And I will be back soon.